accession number 20366, reel 1.
Colonel Norbury, reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in Chingford in Essex.
Which year was this?
1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling at Chingford?
My earliest schooling, yes, but when I was 10, I was sent to Ardingly College in Sussex, and I spent the rest of my schooling there.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
16.
So that would have been in 35?
35, yeah, that is correct, yes. End of 35, yeah.
What did you then do?
I became a management trainee with NAFI. And I worked for NAFI for three and a half years.
Until the war started?
Yes, as soon as the war started, I volunteered to join the army.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes, I did.
Under what circumstances?
Well, I was at the NAFI headquarters in London, and when war was likely to break out, we decided to move the headquarters to Claygate in Surrey, to a place called Ruxley Towers. And I went with the advance party to Ruxley Towers, where we set up the headquarters. And I was there in Claygate. Exactly where I heard it, I honestly don't remember. Possibly in the house I was billeted on a family. They're probably on their radio.
How did you feel about the news?
I realised I must join the army. Of course, our minds were still full, or our thinking of war was related to the stories of the First World War, and so we didn't really expect we would survive the war. But it was one's duty to join the army, so I went to the recruiting office. At that time, my 20th birthday was in the November, and it was in the September when I registered to join, and they weren't taking chaps until they were 20 at that time, and so I didn't actually get called up until the January of 1940, when I was called up and I joined the Queen's Westminsters. We were sent down to the south coast to Folkestone, where we were on coastal. We did a couple of months recruit training, but of course everything we did I already knew because I'd been in the OTC at school. So then I became the carrier platoon commander's driver, driving his carrier. And I did that for about 7 or 8 months when I was selected to go to Octio. And I was sent to Octio. It was 164 Octio, it was called. And we joined in Colchester, where we were living in a barracks. And we'd been there about 3 weeks when it was decided to clear the eastern side of England for frontline troops. And we were marched down to the station and put on a train. We didn't know where we were going. But we woke up amongst the Welsh mountains. And we finished up in Barmouth in North Wales. And I spent the rest of my OCTU training on a feather bed in a boarding house on the front at Barmouth. In December of that year, I was commissioned in the Essex Regiment.
Where did you find the Essex Regiment?
Well, I joined at the depot in Warley, where I spent a couple of weeks. I was then posted to the 10th Battalion, which was on coastal defences in Dovercourt. I was given command of a platoon in C Company, and I had my platoon position in the convent garden on the cliffs in Dovercourt, firing down the beaches.
What kind of reception did you get from the Essex Regiment?
Very good. I was very happy. I've always been happy with the Essex Regiment, and of course most of the chaps in the battalion were wartime soldiers. There weren't many regulars in the battalion, and it was a happy unit. We had a very good commanding officer who really knew how to look after his soldiers, and all was well.
What happened next?
Well, we remained on... Shall I go right through?
Please.
We remained on coastal defences until the early part of 42, when we moved back to Colchester, but I was sent on a long PT course in Aldershot. The battalion was only in Colchester for about a month, and then moved down to Upminster in Essex, where we had the role of a counter-attack onto either Upminster Hornchurch Airfield or North Weald Airfield in the event of them being captured by German parachutists. We practiced this role on both airfields. I had been moved from commanding a platoon in C Company to second in command of the carrier platoon, and then I was moved again to intelligence officer, battalion intelligence officer, which I was by the time we got to Upminster. We did that for a few months, and then we were moved up to North Weald, and then we were moved from North Weald to various locations in Suffolk, and it was at that and then we were moved to St Albans, and it was then that we were visited by General Boy Browning to inform us that we were going to be converted to a parachute battalion.
How did people feel about that?
The reception that he was a great, how do you put it, a public figure, a flamboyant figure, Boy Browning, and he was cheered to the echo by the whole battalion. He spoke to the whole battalion about over 700 strong at the time, and the great enthusiasm that we were going to be a parachute battalion, and then everybody had to volunteer. We moved down to Bulford, which became the base for the battalion for the rest of the war. We then went up to Hardwick for our hardening training. We then went to Ringway outside Manchester for the parachute training, and moved back to Bulford. It's interesting to note that we, although we were 700 strong when we were first told we were being converted, when we'd finished the training and conversion, we were down to 150 people having fallen by the wayside for various reasons. Some volunteered and then decided they didn't like jumping. A few were hurt. But it's interesting that there were a number of battalions converted like us, and every battalion had the same experience of finishing up with the same sort of strength when they finished their training.
And what was this hardening training?
The training at Hardwick was hardening training, yes, where we were subjected to pretty hard... I've forgotten how long it was now. It could have been a month or 6 weeks. And then at Ringway, it was the parachute training.
How did you get on with jumping yourself?
Well, I did it. I didn't enjoy it, but I did it all right. The funny story... Do you like funny stories, isn't it?
Yes, please.
Tom Hearn, our CEO, he was a delightful chap, but he was too old to parachute, and so he wasn't going to stay with us. But in those days, we jumped with hats, which were a rubber band round the edge of the hat, but just with a canvas top. And Tom Hearn always carried a gnarled stick. And when we'd done our first parachute jump, he'd met us on the DZ, and he said... Well, did you enjoy that, Cliff, old chap? And he beat me over the top of the head thinking I had rubber on the top and nearly knocked me out. that was in jest. It wasn't intentional to me. He didn't realise these hats didn't have rubber all over. Anyway, we finished the training. In those days, we did two balloon jumps and then five aircraft jumps. And in those days, we were jumping from Whitley's through a hole in the floor.
Right.
Then we returned to Bulford, and by this time it was early 43, and Tom Hearn handed over command to James Hill. James Hill, I remained IO throughout the whole of this period. James Hill commanded for about 3 months, and then the 3rd Parachute Brigade was formed, and James was promoted to Brigadier to command the 3rd Brigade. Then a chap by the name of Martin Lindsay came to take command, and I was his IO. He was a very nice man. I liked him a lot, but he didn't stay with Lieutenant very long, actually. But then in the summer of 43, I was posted to Divisional Headquarters as Staff Captain Q. You probably appreciate the duties of the Q staff, looking after the logistical side of the division. And I remained with Divisional HQ for the rest of the war.
What were the main problems that you were having at that time in doing your job?
We got top priority, really, with all the supplies we needed. So the problem was getting the division equipped and trained ready for war. And it was a busy time, but I wouldn't pick out any particular problem about doing it. Being a junior staff officer was just getting down to it and making sure everything was needed to be done was done.
What are your next memories?
Well, when this was in, we're now in late 43, and in the spring of 44, of course, we heard that we were going to be involved in the invasion of France, and I suppose about 2 or 3 months before the invasion, we knew what the plan was, and the 6th Airborne Division was to capture the left flank of the bridgehead, destroy the bridges over the River Dives, capture Pegasus Bridge intact over the Orne and the Orne Canal, and put the Merville Battery out of action during the vital early hours of the seaborne landing, all of which tasks we accomplished. I actually flew to Normandy in glider, and I landed in Normandy at about 3:30 in the early morning of D-Day. It was still dark, of course.
What was the flight across like?
It went well. I was lucky. Of course, a hell of a lot of gliders got lost, and when I say lost, landed in the wrong place. And, of course, a number of the parachutists landed in the wrong place as well. But I was lucky. I landed in the right place. On the flight across was okay. We were hit by shrapnel as we crossed the coast. The strange thing about that was that in those days, the Horsa gliders, some loaded through the nose and some loaded through the tail. And I was in a glider which had a tail loading. And the idea was that you drew a bolt on one side of the aircraft and swung the tail sideways on hinges on the other side and get your load out. As a staff officer, I had about 8 chaps in the glider with me and a jeep and trailer with the headquarter equipment in it. But by chance, a bit of this shrapnel hit the bolt of our tail, and we just couldn't get the tail off. So that night, we in fact left our jeep and trailer in the glider. So I set off with my chaps, and we found our rendezvous, and we moved into the Le Bar de Ronville, which is the one side of the village of Ronville, where we set up divisional headquarters. There, of course, the bridgehead then was very narrow, and we were subjected to a tremendous amount of shelling and mortaring, and we had a number of casualties. And a week later, I was promoted. The DA QMG, who was my immediate boss, was moved, and I was promoted to major, and promoted to DA QMG, which is the next stage of in the logistic command of the staff in the staff. And I spent the rest of the war then as DA QMG of 6th Airborne Division. I was lucky; I didn't get hit myself. The nearest I came to get it injured, there's a village called Breville, which was on the left flank, and the Germans hung on to it, and we didn't take it in the initial attack, and it had to be attacked on the 12th of June, because it was high ground which overlooked the bridgehead from the east. There was a lot of casualties suffered there, and I had occasion to go out there. I can't remember now why it was, but I was on an airborne motorbike, which we carried in containers. They had small wheels and collapsible handlebars and seat, and I was hit by a bit of shrapnel on the shoulder, which knocked me off my bike, but did no more than give me a hearty bruise. That was the nearest I came to getting wounded on that occasion. Anyway, we remained in the bridgehead for just over 2 months when the breakout came, and we advanced to the Seine. The job then was to ensure that the service corps with supplies brought supplies to the right points, and the units and brigades knew where supplies were to keep them going. And by September, we'd reached the Seine, and we were brought back to England. We motored back to Arromanches. I came home in a LST to Portsmouth, and we returned to Bulford. But a measure of the casualties, I think it's worth noting that I was PMC of C Mess in divisional headquarters, and 10 of us went on the invasion, and when we came home, there were 3 of us came home. They weren't all killed, but two or three were killed, and others were wounded. But as a measure of the treatment divisional HQ received at the hands of the Boche in Normandy. We then re-equipped and prepared for the next airborne operation, which we assumed fairly soon would be the Rhine crossing.
Just let me interrupt you there. What opinion of the enemy had you all formed in Normandy?
They were a mixed bag. The coastal divisions were pretty low-grade troops. They fought tenaciously from their static positions, but that's about all. But the Panzer, we were, within a very short while, we were attacked by the Panzer Division, the 11th Panzer Division, I think it was, and they were much higher caliber type of troop, and they fought ferociously and well. And there's no doubt about it, they gave us a hard time.
And the casualties at DivHQ were mainly because of what kind of...
Shelling and mortaring. Once we'd broken out, of course, then the problem was over from DivHQ point of view.
Did you have much contact with civilians in Normandy?
It's an interesting point, that. I was often asked that, and I was never conscious of seeing civilians. In the chateau where... I was dug in behind this chateau, but there was one old caretaker living in the basement of it. But you didn't see... During that bridgehead period, you didn't see many civilians. In fact, I wasn't conscious of seeing civilians at all during that time. When we started the advance, then it was a different matter. Every village we went through, we were fated by by the civilian population, plied with Calvados and other fiery waters. And we got a tremendous reception. As we went forward, the reception was absolutely fantastic in every village we went through.
Did you have any contact with the French resistance?
Well, yes. It was usually the French resistance that greeted us. and most, as far as I can remember, most villages we went through, one saw a few chaps with Tommy guns or Sten guns or something, you know, who were part of the resistance.
What opinion of them did you form?
They were obviously very brave people. They must have been living with the Germans all around them and taking up arms against them. And they were overjoyed to see us, and they appeared to be jolly good types. But then, of course, we moved on, and there we were.
Had you expected the Normandy campaign to be more difficult or easier than it proved to be?
I had never been out of England before we invaded Normandy. I didn't know what to expect. I tell people what gave me great confidence when we went. We flew from Harwell airfield. We went onto the airfield and saw the serried ranks of gliders lined up and the tugs lined up. Stretching the distance, my thought was, well, somebody's got to survive this, and one of them's going to be me. I remember thinking that. I think one's thoughts, one was obviously anxious, and one's thoughts were really, were you going to survive or weren't you going to survive? I think we were confident we'd do our task. We never felt there was any possibility of the invasion failing, I don't think.
Sorry, I interrupted your chronology with your saying that you thought you were preparing for the Rhine crossing.
Oh, yes. But just before Christmas, the Boche broke through in the Ardennes, you'll recall, and the Battle of the Bulge was developing. And it was on... or 2 days before Christmas, I think, I was detailed to take the divisional advance party out to Belgium with a view to stemming the German breakthrough in the Ardennes. And I rushed off with a small party from each unit, each brigade and each unit in the division. And we went to Tilbury and went across from Tilbury. I forgot where we landed now, somewhere in Belgium, and drove across Belgium to Namur, and villages around Namur, we set up bivouacking areas for all the units of the division. The division came over, and we then moved down to Dinan on the Meuse, where we virtually finished up at the tip of the German advance. But by that time, the German thrust was almost a spent force. It was the conditions in the Ardennes, or in the whole of Belgium, pretty horrific. Everything was frozen. You were sliding all over the place in your vehicles. And I think it's probably the weather conditions as much as anything that slowed the Germans up. Anyway, we crossed the Meuse and then proceeded to push the Germans back. All three brigades got involved in a certain amount of fighting, but only one battalion suffered serious casualties. That was the 12th or 13th battalion at a place called Bure. They had a 12th battalion. They had a hard time at Bure and had a lot of casualties. They got into. They'd been put under. No, I better not say that. They'd got into a bit of a valley between where the high ground was held by the Germans on either side, and they suffered. But they were the only unit to seriously suffer in the Ardennes. We'd been there when the line had been straightened out. There, we were moved up into Holland on the Maas, where we sat on the Maas, holding a section of the front there for another month or so. And late February, early March, the airborne element of the division was rushed back to England. We left our sea tail in Europe, but the airborne element, which I accounted for probably something like three quarters of the strength of the division, came back to England for the assault across the Rhine. We got back to England. We had a short while to prepare, and on the 24th of March, with the 17th American Airborne Division, we've performed the biggest airborne operation of the war in daylight. Again, I went by glider, but on this occasion, the logistics staff at Div HQ consisted of the AQ, a Lieutenant Colonel, myself as the DAQ, and the DAG. I had a much rougher landing over the Rhine. As we came into land, it was very difficult for the pilots because there was smoke everywhere. The ground troops, you'll probably recall, had invaded, had crossed the Rhine in the early hours of the day and put down a lot of smoke to get across, and smoke had drifted right across. And we were landing more or less in the German gun lines. As we came into land, we hit a bank that that took the base out of our glider, and with it went, we had our haversacks between our legs. They all vanished. I ordered the chaps out as soon as we came to a halt, and we stopped very close to a vegetable clump that German farmers had dug. We dived into this, and as we dived into it, a German shell hit the glider, and everything in the glider went up in smoke. And that was the end of our jeep trailer and all our kit. And there we were in this hole. Anyway, we were roughly in the right place. And I went to where it had been decided to set up divisional headquarters, which we did. And my job then was to call in the air resupply as soon as I was satisfied that the dropping zone for the supply was adequately secure. Luckily, the Aerolink radio to Moor Park, which by that time was the Airborne Corps headquarters in England, had arrived safely, and I got through to Moor Park and said it was okay to send in the air resupply. And a side story here is, I recognised the chap at the other end had been in Divisional HQ with me, and I recognised his voice. And when I finished my transmission, I said, "Tell Eileen I'm okay." Eileen was my wife. And by lunchtime, she'd had a phone call to say I'd landed safely and wasn't dead. But I then discovered the other two officers with me, the AQ and the DAG, had both been killed. So I was the only logistics chap left to run the logistics of the division, which I proceeded to do reasonably satisfactorily, I think. We were there for three or four days when the advance across Germany commenced. And then...
What did you do in those 3 or 4 days?
Well, just we resupplied the division. The service corps picked up the resupply, and very shortly then our sea tail, which came across the river, joined up with us. I was re-equipped with a jeep and trailer and a knife, fork and spoon, other things I needed. And we then set off on the advance across Germany. It's interesting that on the Normandy invasion, the parachutists came off worse, but on the Rhine crossing, the gliderborne troops came off worse because we were coming down almost on top of the German guns, and so the gliderborne troops had heavier casualties than the parachute troops did on the Rhine crossing. Then it was... The brigades fought a number of engagements going across Germany, various river lines, etc. At one point, we were going to mount which river, I've forgotten, the river that comes out at Hamburg,